This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The fact is, and everybody knows it, America's cities are bluer than its suburbs and countryside. Lately, a lot of those blue cities are trying to go their own way and being reined in by red state legislatures, and maybe next by Donald Trump's federal government on issues from guns to wages to who uses what bathroom. This hour on Point, blue cities, red states, Trump's Washington, and what happens now. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on who should decide how cities live, and when should states preempt city regulations, ordinances, law? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Examples are all over the place lately. In December, the city of Charlotte went up against the state of North Carolina on the issue of transgender bathroom use. The city took a progressive stance, the state conservative, the state won. Here's Charlotte Mayor Jennifer Roberts on the issue.
All we want to do is let Charlotte be Charlotte and let our cities thrive and prosper and be the laboratories of innovation and creativity and talent that we know they can be if they're not preempted by the state every time they try to do something innovative.
But states are coming down hard. Here's Texas Governor Greg Abbott. He was on the radio show, The Mark Levin Show, yesterday. He talked about how he plans to make it impossible for cities in Texas to incorporate sanctuary city policies. For example, Austin, Texas, in Travis County.
Texas is not going to stand for it. What I've done is I have withheld $1.5 million in governor grants to Travis County. And I'm seeking legislation. We are working on it, passed out of a Senate committee yesterday, that is going to really put the hammer down on any sanctuary city policies. We're going to be asserting fines. We're going to be seeking court orders that could lead to putting these people behind bars, the officials who are violating their oath of office.
We're set up for a real conflict here. Put people behind bars. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, following after Donald Trump's election, said he would defend undocumented immigrants and their families that remain New York City a sanctuary city.
We are not going to sacrifice a 500,000 people who live amongst us, who are part of our community, whose, you know, family members and loved ones happen to be people, in many cases, who are either permanent residents or citizens. We're not going to tear families apart. So we will do everything we know how to do to resist that.
Joining me today from Durham, North Carolina, is David Graham, staff writer at The Atlantic. His recent piece is headlined Red State, Blue City, and it's all about this emerging conflict right across the country. You can link to that piece at our website, onpointradio.org. David Graham, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
What's going on here?
What you have is really, I think, a symptom of the cleavage that's going on in the country as cities become more and more left-leaning, which makes rural areas more and more conservative. At the same time, you have conservative areas increasingly dominating state legislatures. And as a result, you have this tension between cities that really want to push the envelope on policy issues, on things like bathrooms or minimum wages or really any number of things, and states that are unwilling to let them do that and have the capacity to really crack down.
Which brings us back to what's called preemption. What does that mean?
So, you know, we see this all kinds of times in federal and state law. States want to do something and the federal government says, actually, that's our prerogative and you can't legislate on that. And what we see is the same thing at the state level. So a city wants to do something and the state comes in and says, actually, we're not going to let you do that. For example, a city might decide that it wants to pass a higher minimum wage than the state minimum wage. And then the state might then pass a law that says, actually, no city can pass a law, a minimum wage that is any higher than ours. And there are any number of issues where the state can come in and prevent that. And what we're seeing increasingly is states are coming in and doing that.
I mean, we've got lots of examples of this and all kinds of issues now. I'm reading here 32 states now prohibit localities, cities included, from regulating companies like Uber. 23 ban the states ban the local raising of the minimum wage. 15 states ban cities from requiring companies to offer sick days. You've got several now ban anti-discrimination ordinances that protect lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender residents. This is it a growing trend of states coming in and saying no, no, no to what cities are pushing for or doing?
So the people who keep the closest track of this is a group called Preemption Watch, which is actually an outgrowth of another activist organization called Grassroots Change. And what they say is that there is, in fact, really a growing trend. More and more this is happening. Anecdotally, you definitely see that. And I think part of that is states being more willing to flex their muscles. And part of that is cities pushing harder on these issues.
Take us back to the politics behind this. I mean, you remind us that Hillary Clinton won 88 of the country's biggest counties, that's cities, you could say. So there really are different politics here in the cities and in the suburbs and rural areas.
That's right. And I think that's really pronounced in particularly in places in the South, in places like North Carolina, where I am, but also in other states. I mean, Texas, from the introduction, is a good example. In a state like North Carolina, Charlotte, Raleigh, Durham, Greensboro, these cities are very liberal. They're sort of bastions of Democratic power. But the rest of the state remains fairly conservative, and Republicans have an extremely strong hold on the state legislature. And so you see this tension growing between the two of them.
So you've got Democrats in a way, I don't know if as Democrats or just because these people living in the cities, they want to live a certain way. They're pushing for ordinances that frame that up. And then the state comes in, the people not living in that city by and large, let's say, and says, no, where's the power here, David?
Exactly. And this drives people in the cities crazy. They say, you know, this is our community. We just want to live the way we want to live. We're not trying to bother anyone else. We're not trying to dictate to voters who are outside. And what they keep getting smacked down. There's an interesting irony because, for years, Democrats have espoused the importance of federal muscle to do things, whether that's, for example, to integrate schools or to legalize gay marriage. While Republicans have argued, we really need local control. Bureaucrats in Washington don't know what's best. This is actually a line
states
from
rights
the Republican
kind of
platform
argument
a few years ago. Exactly. And now you see this interesting switch where suddenly liberals are saying, well, wait a second. This is really a local issue. You should let us do what we want. And conservative legislatures are saying, well, no, actually, we need uniformity. It's very important that we do this.
Uniformity is often the cry, but I don't know if it's really about uniformity or about just not liking city policies. And the range is incredible. You remind us, Arizona, the state came in to say cities can't ban those little gifts in Happy Meals. What the cities had talked about outlawing them on the theory that they would lure kids to McDonald's and that kind of food. When some of its cities cracked down on puppy mills, churning out, pups, Arizona barred local regulation of pet breeders. You remind us, cities in Oklahoma can't regulate e-cigarettes because of state law there. Mississippi said towns, cities can't ban sugary drinks. The beverage industry is looking to get other states to do the same thing. I mean, it's all kinds of things that are the state saying no to more progressive city policies.
That's exactly right. And I think it is politics. It's politics that seems to fit into two sometimes overlapping groups. One is kind of moral issues. So those are things like the bathroom laws not only moral, but very political, ideologically things. Bathroom laws, gun control, those are things that get preempted a lot. On the other hand, you have things that are business interests. So you mentioned the Happy Meal gifts, puppy mills, things like living wage laws are very much about things that the business lobby objects to. It doesn't want these regulations, and so it tends to push state legislatures to crack down on the cities and enforce these kind of conservative views on regulation.
I mean, it drives the cities crazy sometimes. You're there in North Carolina, and you quote the mayor of Asheville, North Carolina, Esther Mannheimer, saying, look, we're a very desirable city to live in. We're on all the top 10 lists. How would anyone have an issue with the way Asheville's running its city, the things that they want? And yet, the state comes in and says no to this, no to that.
That's exactly right. And I think it's particularly frustrating because every mayor I talk to says something like this. And while they may be right on a sort of political or moral level, usually the law is with the states and the states can do what they want to interfere and to overrule the cities.
It's weird because these days in cities have their economic problems and neighborhoods, I guess. But overall, cities are huge economic engines now, doing better than rural areas. It's sort of different from the historical sort of rich agricultural countryside. And even so, I mean, you've got, what is it? If you just look at New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, the three biggest cities, all each of those has more economic output than all but six states in the country. And yet states have the power politically.
That's right. And if you look at the difference in the presidential election, it's similar in terms of where the economic output is. I think actually that division tends to drive some of the resentment. You have resentment towards cities that exist because they are doing well while, you know, other parts of states are struggling. And so that then manifests itself in other ways. When I spoke with Jennifer Roberts, the mayor of Charlotte, you know, she said, I understand that we have this reputation for not playing well with the rest of the state, and I don't like it, but I know that it's out there. And, you know, we try to do what we can to help rural counties, and we try to explain that if Charlotte is doing poorly, it hurts everyone around us, but that message doesn't always get through to people.
Your headline is, maybe you didn't write it, but it says, the United States is coming to resemble two countries, one rural and one urban. What happens when they go to war? That's provocative. I mean, okay, let's leave the pistols and the muskets at home, but it's getting pretty tense out there.
That's right. I mean, I do think you have effectively in some places what looks like two different states. You know, it used to be that we could rely on these regional deviations, but now in a state like North Carolina, you have kind of a one state that's a blue state that is an archipelago of Charlotte and the Research Triangle and Greensboro and cities like that. And then you have the rest of the state. You have that in a place like Texas, which we think of as being the deepest red state, but Houston is a Democratic city. Austin is a very Democratic city. San Antonio is a Democratic city. Even Dallas tends to lean toward the Democratic side of the aisle. And so you have these really stark divisions. And it means that somebody isn't going to get what they want because somebody isn't going to have full self-determination as long as the states are telling the cities how to govern themselves.
So are cities giving up on this, saying, ah, boy, the states are going to check us every time we try this? We give up. We quit.
It doesn't seem that way. So far, they're pushing, whether that's in the courts or simply trying to do what they can and making the states intervene and crack down.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American cities trying to go their own way on policy and running into opposition, being overruled, preempted very often by their own states. It's interesting how the politics are breaking down here. And you've got clashes all over the country now between state legislatures and local governments, often cities. That could go national soon in a big way. Donald Trump, with his immigration push or anti-immigration in many ways, says no to sanctuary cities. He said that on the campaign trail as well. Here he was in August. This was a speech in Phoenix, Arizona. Then candidate Donald Trump talked about how he would take a hard stance on sanctuary cities.
Block funding for sanctuary cities. We block the funding. No more funding. We will end the sanctuary cities that have resulted in so many needless deaths. Cities that refuse to cooperate with federal authorities will not receive taxpayer dollars.
And of course, he raised that same message shortly after taking office as President Donald Trump. You can join us this hour. If cities are more liberal, progressive, open, communitarian than the countryside, even the suburbs, should they feel free to go their own way? Are states right to intervene and say no, 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 or the federal government for that matter? Are we splitting into two countries here, one rural, one urban? Can we all just get along? David Graham is with us from Durham, North Carolina, staff writer at The Atlantic. Put together a great piece on this. You can link to it at our website. It's called Red State, Blue City. With us right now as well from Nashville, Tennessee, is Mary Ewells. She's a children's book illustrator and an On Point listener. And in fact, today's show we're doing because Mary proposed it online at our website, onpointradio.org. She went to our On Point Listens page, and as part of our 2017 National Listening Tour, she stepped right up to the app there where you can give us ideas for local stories you think might make good programs. You can check it out at onpointradio.org. Mary Ewells, thanks so much for your suggestion that we look at this. Thanks for joining us today from Nashville.
Thank you so much, Tom. Thank you for having me.
What got you interested in this, interested enough to say, hey, On Point, you ought to look at this?
Well, a couple of years ago in Nashville, there was a skirmish between an ordinance that was voted on by the city that would have allowed us to continue keeping guns out of city parks. And the state legislator got involved, and they created legislation that overrode that ban. But it was very narrowly defined, where it would have only applied to Nashville and Memphis. And there was just a lot of disagreement locally about it. And the way I looked at it was, we as the citizens of Davidson County, Nashville, Tennessee, we pay for those city parks. And, you know, if we pay for it, why don't we get to say what happens in our parks? As opposed to it being, you know, being sort of pushed by a legislator from outside the county, maybe even not anywhere near Nashville. And then I've noticed it more recently. There was a decision made by our school board that they decided to delay the decision on charter schools because they expected that if they went ahead with the vote that the state would get involved. So I've just began to notice it more and more that the local control might back off because of interference from the state.
How does it make you feel as a citizen and resident of your, you know, municipality that you know, your local government, with support from local people, votes for something, and then just to see it overturned by the state government?
Well, it makes me kind of irritated, actually, because, like I said, we, you know, I'm a resident, a voter, a taxpayer in Nashville, Davidson County, and I feel like if we decide something for just for our county, we should be able to decide it.
But Mary, you—I mean, you live in Nashville. You know the history here. There was a long time when, in the South, for example, you had racial or racist laws that the federal government would come in and overturn, and progressives didn't complain then.
You know, that's a good point, and I've actually thought about that a lot, just around this issue. You know, I would actually kind of like to see what would it look like from the other side, where I would want a state to step in, or, you know, or a federal government to step in. And I guess in something like that, I would. And actually, just this morning, I was talking to my husband about it and saying, you know, what would that situation look like? And it would be something like civil rights. But I feel like, you know, particularly going back to the original issue that got me interested in this, it was, yes, the rights of one, you know, one people to carry a gun, but also the rights of a city to determine what's safe and what's not safe in their city parks. So to be honest with you, I realize there's still some gray area there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, but I still feel like we should have some self-determination.
When you wanted, when your local communities said no to guns in city parks, who did you come up against or what? What was on the other side of that state legislative vote?
Well, I mean, we're in, our state legislature is, you know, more Republican than not.
Mm-hmm.
And while our, you know, local, our Nashville representatives are, you know, they were for Nashville's ability to create, you know, our own ordinance. It was just sort of overwhelmingly run over in the state house. I'm not even really sure there was very much pushback. I believe there was a little bit where they said, okay, well, we'll try to water it down somewhere. Maybe the city can come in and decide exactly when and where. But basically, it just created a lot of confusion, and then it just got left alone.
Mary, stand by there in Nashville. And again, we're very grateful to you for raising this at our website, onpointradio.org. And for other listeners who want to go to the On Point Listens page, it's part of our 2017 National Listening Tour. We're paying attention. If you've got stories that you think would be good for us to talk about right here, pound them right in there. You'll see exactly the place to do that. There's a window for it there. David Graham, stand by as well. Michelle Wild Anderson joins us right now from San Francisco. She's a professor of law at Stanford, expertise in state and local government. Michelle Wild Anderson, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
You just heard Mary Yule's story out of Nashville. They voted there to keep guns out of the parks, and the state overrode. Is that just the way of the world in America's legal system, Michelle?
Well, I think as you captured so well, sometimes you're up and sometimes you're down. And I think what Mary was struggling with is really the heart of this issue, which is how do you have a set of principles that guide you regardless of whether your party is in power at the state level and whether your party is in power locally? How do you have some standards that govern when it's appropriate for a state to be the decision maker and when it should be left to local governments to be different from one another and to work things out locally.
But in terms of raw power, do cities have a leg to stand on finally, Michelle? I mean, or is it the state that really, after the federal, I mean, even the federal government is kind of by the agreement of the states. The states are quite powerful in our system.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Local governments like cities and counties have much less power than people think. Local governments can't act unless they have authority from the state to act. And even when they have that power, states can preempt that local law. So that's what David Graham was capturing, that states can essentially override a local law using preemption and say, you overreached here. We gave you the authority to experiment in this general area, but this category of lawmaking goes too far.
Let's go to Mark in Syracuse, New York. Mark, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if one of your guests could maybe touch on the topic of the reason why cities are bluer than these counties are. And I'm, in my opinion, it has to do with the fact that when you live next to people and you live amongst a lot of people, you learn to get along. It seems like a lot of these state overridden laws are a lot to do with social issues, bathrooms, carrying guns, education, things like that. And I feel that there's a reason cities are cities, and that's because that's where most of the jobs are, most of the housing is. Most of all these people that live together, they learn to get along. So things like seeing a gay couple or a transgender person or a biracial couple even, that's not a big deal to people that live in the cities. And I'm wondering when we're going to stop kowtowing or catering to the people that just haven't, I don't know, I said to the screener earlier, if I can put this more eloquently, but to the rest of the country that just hasn't caught up yet.
Yeah, Mark, I'm really glad for your call. Hang on there. David Graham, speak to this. I mean, listeners who live in rural areas may say, what do you mean catch up? This is the way we want our society to be, cities included. But Mark looks at it and says, come on, we're making the future here, and take the harness off.
Yeah, I mean, I think the argument for local control is, it's fine if cities and rural areas are in different places because they have different governing systems and they should be able to choose to live the way they want to differently. His point about cities becoming the way they are is interesting, and there are different hypotheses about how we've gotten to where we are. When you go back to the roots of states preempting cities, it goes back to the 19th century and sort of concerns about immigrants and subversive political views taking root in cities. But even now, I mean, today we have what appears to be an accelerated trend. Cities are more and more liberal compared to rural areas. And whether that's because people are moving to cities and becoming liberal or because people are liberal and therefore moving to cities, there seems to be a sort of complex interplay between those things. But it does appear to be accelerating.
Mel in Versailles, Missouri. Mel, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, just a couple of comments. I'm maybe out of the mainstream here because I'm rural. I live on a farm in Central Missouri.
I love it.
But I love listening to your program and really appreciate that. And I believe in diversity of input. So listening to that is not naturally what I'm listening to your show, not naturally my politics, but I really appreciate support. My comment is that cities sometimes act as if they live in a vacuum, going back to the city state that every duchy and every dukedom can write their own laws and have their own rules about how citizens are governed. But that it really is living in a vacuum. For one thing, they're not the rest of the country. I mean, we saw from this past election, at least half the people don't agree with some policies and want to change.
Yep.
And so I think really a lot of your speakers and the people who called in have touched on the fundamental question of representative democracy, which is, we don't act as independent agents, but our society has tended to make us all feel like we're independent. We don't need each other as much for advice now that we have YouTube and Google as we did before. So we tend in some ways to think of ourselves as independent agents. And that's not representative democracy, and that's not really who we are as a country.
Mel, I totally understand your point. I really do. And yet, think with us here. If you've got millions and millions of people in cities who want their community, their society to evolve in a certain direction, and are reined in by people who live elsewhere but don't like that direction. Doesn't that feel odd at the same time, Elle, or am I wrong?
Well, it doesn't feel as odd as if they were really independent, but we still have a lot of the country and a lot of the economic activity. And I really feel a great condescension coming from some of the speakers, especially the guy that wrote the article in the paper about, well, it's just the people that are jealous of all the money in the cities. I can differ from opinions about people that live in cities without being jealous. I mean, that's a condescension. And then some of the speakers have also said, yep, look, we got the money, we got to make the rules. Come on. Where's the talk for the little guy that I hear so much about? You know, if we are all citizens and we all have input, then we need to respect that. It's not a given that one point of view is better than another.
Mel, hold that thought. Stick right there in Missouri. Mary Ewell's in Nashville, Tennessee. What do you say to fellow citizen Mel who says, come on, you're not an independent dukedom or duchy. We're part of one big democracy, and give us a break.
Well, I understand that, and for the record, I actually grew up in a small town in a small rural community, so I feel like I've sort of seen both sides. And I do agree that maybe for some, you know, some very large issues, we do need to think of it, you know, more as we're all kind of in this together. But just going back to, you know, my specific situation that started my concern about this is, you know, we aren't going out to Bucksmart, Tennessee, and asking them to pay for our parks. We're paying for that out of our local option, off of our sales tax. So, you know, I don't really think that the citizens of Bucksmart should be, you know, responsible for our city parks. It's up to Nashville to be responsible for our city parks. So at some point, I don't want to say, you know, no, it's our city, we can do it our way. I don't want to continue the divide of, you know, we're over here and you're over there. But at some level, there has to be some recognition that, you know, yes, we decided this, we fund it, we take care of it. We're not trying to decide this for all city parks. We just wanted to decide this for our Davidson County City Park.
Mel, what do you say? Mary pays for that park with her neighbors. They take care of it, and they don't want guns in it.
Well, there's two issues, really, to me. One is that just because you pay for it doesn't mean you should be able to do it if it's outside of the law of the land. And so we do have to make some distinction between what's available and suitable for all the citizens of the country to make a decision about and what should be local control. I mean, that's our form of government. And courts and legislatures do get a role and input in that. So, I mean, I'd say to Mary that you are right that at some level you need to be able to decide how you're going to do it. But I think the sanctuary city is a big deal about who sets federal policy about immigration. And I really have great hopes, and I've wanted immigration policy to be set properly for the last 30 years, ever since it's been talked about. I really hope it becomes such a mess right now that we have to make a decision in the legislature. It's a perfect opportunity for the legislatures. You've got people on one side that want everybody to come in, people on the other side that wants nobody to come in. It's a perfect opportunity for the legislature, for the Congress, to really act, and President Trump to really act and set policy so we can quit fighting about this and be fair to people.
Mel, we've got it. I'm coming up on a break here, so forgive me. I'm going to have to let you go. Mel in Versailles, Missouri, but I really appreciate your call. Call again. Michelle Wilde Anderson, here we are. I mean, that's sort of the classic confrontation there between city and country, and both seem to have some reasonable points, Michelle.
They do, but I think it was so, that exchange highlighted so well that cities and rural areas are in this joint democracy under the state, and they both have needs from the state. And I think Mel put that really well. The democratic law of the land at the state level is really important. But Mary really captured that sometimes cities and rural areas are really different. So one good example of that that's driven a lot of this red state, blue city conflict is the cost of living. So the cost of living is really high in cities, and that's in some cities, and that's driven some of these minimum wage protections.
Mary Ewells, I'm going to say goodbye to you at this point, but we're very, very grateful to you for raising this really interesting subject. You raised it at our website in the On Point Listens page there, part of the listening tour that we're up to this year. Mary in Nashville, thanks a lot, and good luck there. Keep listening.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Rocket Mortgage provides a transparent online process that helps you understand all the details of your home loan. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the right mortgage solution for you. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American cities trying to go their own way on policy and running into opposition from their own states. And now from Donald Trump's Washington as well, on issues from guns to wages to bathrooms and plastic bags, sanctuary cities, the whole kit and caboodle here. You can join us this hour. Is it obvious to you that state law should trump local regulation? Do you want your city to stand for a particular way of life? What if other residents in your state aren't ready to roll with that? David Graham is with us from The Atlantic. Michelle Wild Anderson is here from Stanford, professor of law there. Joining us right now from Columbus, Ohio, is Edward Ned Hill, professor of public administration, city and regional planning at Ohio State University. Ned Hill, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for asking me to be on.
It can feel like, I mean, David's written it up very well, but it can feel like we're in a real high-pressure period of tension between cities and their surrounding states. What's driving it, and how in line or out of line with history is it?
Well, there always has been rural-urban tension throughout history, but this particular set of conflict is different. The first thing is what we're seeing is very surgical redistricting has taken cities and powers away from cities and from their immediate suburbs. The second is that this is being pitched as rural versus urban, but there are not enough votes in the rural area, particularly to end up with results like we saw from the last election. And it's small to mid-sized cities that aren't part of big metros have really been their sense of opportunity and economic future has been disrupted. Retail is gone. It's bricks and clicks are at work. And also the increasing productivity in factories has made the sense of we can hold on to our kids much weaker. But I'll keep on coming back to it. It's cities and their fulcrum suburbs that are important, making certain that those courthouse square towns, the county seats, those people feel like they've got an opportunity, and most importantly is take on the issue of redistricting so that we try to keep levels of government whole, keep cities whole, counties whole, and that way you'll have a much more representative legislature.
And we're going to talk with the mayor of Tallahassee, Florida, Andrew Gillum, in a couple of minutes here, who's wrestling with this right now. Lots of different kinds of response from around the country online here. It's interesting. Paul says to us on Twitter, great show. He says, on cities versus rural. Fact is, he writes, cities live in the future. Rural areas increasingly live in the past. Well, okay, but you heard our Missouri caller there saying, look, don't look down on me just because I'm out here on the farm. I got a view, too. Got a representative democracy. John writes, progressives are great at passing laws and providing benefits that others must pay for, like enhanced pension payments to city employees. That's why states need to act like parents to these quote-unquote children. Oh, okay. But Hello Kitty writes, she says, it's absolute hypocrisy that red states would come in and override local laws and statutes when all they do is cry about the expansion of federal government. I mean, Ned, it is ironic here because states' rights has been the cry of a lot of conservative Americans for a long time.
And it makes sense because the Constitution and the federal government was formed by a grant of power from the states through the Constitution to form federal government. And municipalities, they get their powers also from the states. In fact, many of them are called municipal corporations. So the powers they get are also determined by the state.
But the states don't want the federal government coming in to tell them what to do, but they're happy to come in and put a foot on local governments when they get out of their desired path.
Well, cities don't have constitutional standing. Mm-hmm. And you can go back to the 60s and the actions that took place in the Johnson and the Kennedy administrations with direct grants from the federal government to the cities that left the states out. The states figured out that, well, the power has to come in, and now those funds are coming through the state. It really represents what's taking place or with the Constitution. But I'll go back to it. Until we have voting districts at the state level and the congressional level that honor the integrity of local government and county governments and build up from there rather than these fabulous gerrymanders that are all that streak along the state, you are going to have very frustrated democracy.
Michelle Wild Anderson in San Francisco, I want to ask you about that. We've got a listener, Jill, here. Who's saying, don't forget gerrymandering, Ned's point. She says, cities are broken up so that we cannot even have the representatives we want. She says, I live in a Democratic city and a Republican county. The place was gerrymandered in such a way that I'll probably never see a Democrat representing where I live and who I am again. Savannah, Georgia, she says, Democratic city. If the state Republican government ties the hands of our city with Republican laws, then when do we get a chance to govern? Does this come into play in the law, Michelle? Could cities ultimately, I don't know, sue the state saying we don't have proper representation because of this gerrymandering?
Well, I mean, there's two different kinds of borders that person might be referring to. There's the districts at the state legislature that, you know, a city sits in districts in their state senate and their state house of representatives. And but then there's also the local borders themselves. And in most states, the city governments do control the districts for their own governments. So the city of Nashville and the borders of the city of Nashville, the districts within Nashville, those are usually locally controlled across the country. But what's amazing about this current moment of state experimentation with overriding local law is that states are starting to push on that second category, where they are starting to experiment with whether states can control local voting districts within the city government itself. And that is, I think, quite new. And I don't think a lot of those have really gotten past the drawing board at this point, but that's definitely a new frontier.
Yeah.
It's a deeper intervention because it would validate that writer's concern that all of a sudden I have my own local government and I can't even influence the borders of, you know, the districts in my own town.
A couple calls, and I want to go to Mayor Gillum from Tallahassee, but Gerard in Maine, Pittsfield, Maine. Gerard, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Listen, I'm just wondering what can the town, if the state comes in and tells the town they can't do this or that, can the town turn around and withhold sending money to the state when the state is saying, well, we're not going to, if you don't do what we say, we're not going to revenue share. And the same thing with the federal government. Can the states turn around and not send the federal government the money?
Well, let's stick with cities for a second, Gerard. I appreciate your call. Ned, what about it?
Can't happen. The cities don't collect taxes and then funnel them up to higher levels of government. The residents pay their taxes directly.
And so the cities can't, even though they're often big engines of economic strength in a state, they can't exercise that directly. They can't threaten to withhold.
No, they can't. I mean, Brookings Institution did a really interesting piece right after the election where, you know, they found out that Hillary Clinton won the economy and President Trump won the Electoral College.
Boy, it is wild, though, because you've got an economic fissure there. You've got a kind of cultural fissure there.
Well, and then if you think about the state of Maine, Governor LePage has run for two terms by running against the city of Portland and all of southern Maine.
Yeah.
And he's essentially running and castigating the part of the state that's paying the taxes for the rest of the state. So then if we go back to the issue of redistricting, the city of Akron is split up in five different house districts, so it effectively has no voice.
Larry in Oklahoma City. Oklahoma, Larry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've been listening to this for a while, years, in fact. But I grew up, I'm 61, and I grew up in a rural area in Kentucky.
Okay.
I farmed until I was 40.
Okay.
Got a BA after that, then an MA, married, ended up in Oklahoma City and married a second time.
All right.
But I don't think that anybody realizes how serious all of this is.
Tell us. What do you mean, Larry?
I grew up in a racist culture, and in a way, I'm still a racist because it's still inside me. It was so ingrained that it's taken me a long time to shed the nastier parts of it.
Okay.
And I know a lot of very intelligent, caring, God-fearing people who have voted for Trump, went the direction they're going, and they're being manipulated, and it's not really their fault.
But what do you think about this rural-urban divide and preempting, you know, the city wants this, the rural area or the state wants that? What's going on? What's at stake there?
Dude, if this push comes to shove, the Tea Party and their backers and the rural people who voted Trump in, they'll fight. Like, this could go bad.
Bad? What do you mean go bad, Larry?
I mean, there could be a civil war. Like, people will fight for their way of life and their culture, and they'll do it even if they don't understand that they're wrong, because they are.
Whoa, I appreciate your call. Ned, can you see the divide? I mean, that's the most dire kind of view of what could emerge here, but if the culture and economic fissures are deep enough, how does this get resolved?
Well, there is a cultural divide. There is, on the part of people who live in city areas, kind of a denigration of things that are rural, it be it hunting, ice fishing, snowmobiling.
Yeah, be careful about that. Mm-hmm.
And or it can be NASCAR. So what we really do have to do, the politics is won by splitting us apart and not really having a vision of shared destiny. In this great state of Ohio, we've got 8 metro areas, but we really need a statewide discussion because agriculture is part of what we export. In fact, our largest export market with agriculture is Mexico, but that's a different show. That we have close emotional connections as well as legal connections between these towns, which are like Tiffin, Ohio. Their population has dropped almost by half. And what happens to Tiffin is important to both Toledo and to Cleveland. So this notion of building a shared sense of a future about opportunity, the importance of work, the importance of family, that should be a statewide conversation.
I want to take it, if I may, to Tallahassee, Florida. We've got a dire warning there from Oklahoma City saying, watch out, these could be sort of battle lines in a civil war. We hope it doesn't go anywhere near that. Mayor Andrew Gillum in Tallahassee, Florida, Democrat there, has been kind of in the thick of this whole issue. He has had a city ordinance prohibiting the firing of guns in city parks. That's become controversial. He joins us now from Tallahassee. Mayor Gillum, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. And you were as surprised as I was that was a controversial thought, that you can't fire a gun in a park where our kids play and our families picnic. But because the battle lines have been drawn and there's been such an erosion of what is common sense when it comes to some of these things, that's kind of the battle we find ourselves in right now.
So has the state of Florida come down against your law on the firing of guns in city parks?
Yeah, well, not only have they come down on the law, they've come down on it in the most unprecedented of ways. Basically, the special, you know, gun lobby interest has been able to compel on the Florida legislature to pass one of the most radical forms of preemption that we've been able to see. In Florida, locals cannot regulate guns. And if we do, if we vote to do that, we can be personally sued. So they remove immunity from us so that we can be personally sued for decisions we make in our elected capacities. We can be fined up to $5,000 personally. We can be responsible for legal fees of the opposing party up to $100,000.
Wow.
And we can be removed from public office at the discretion of the governor, all because of a public policy difference around what regulations should be done at the city level and what should be done by the state. This is the most extreme form of preemption that we've seen and that we've been able to find.
That, Mayor Gillen, may I just clarify? That's passed. Yeah. That's done. You're hogtied in that way, and that's a done deal in Florida?
Yeah, since 2011, that's been the law. And it's unfortunate, but this is a battle that is being fought. And I heard the conversation around rural versus urban. That's certainly not how I look at it. I mean, I think this is a real, you know, local versus state problem. And we see it play out on the federal level all the time where states say, we don't have to do that. And they won on that issue when it came to the expansion of Medicaid. And all we're saying is that we ought to have, you know, some jurisdiction because we're elected by people at the local level. They elect their mayors, their school board members, their city council members to do everything from, you know, regulating where you might be able to fire a gun to water quality issues to living wage issues to local zoning to anti-fracking.
You've blamed this gun business. You've blamed the crackdown on your gun law on the NRA. Why is the NRA perhaps more powerful at the state level than right there in your town, Tallahassee?
Well, I mean, first of all, nationally, I think they've got a membership of about 5 million, and yet I think they control what happens in the United States Senate and the United States Congress. It's a very, very powerful interest. I get it. And the truth is all we're trying to say to our state electeds is that while their policies may make sense from one county to another, to have a blanket policy on this, regardless of what challenges each community faces, we think is wrong. And we also think the overreach of this particular legislation is wrong.
Mayor Gillen, do you think cities are just going to give up here, that they'll hear states saying shut up and sit down and just say, okay?
No, the exact opposite. It's kind of why I founded this new group, the Campaign to Defend Local Solutions, because it's while my battle may be on guns, in other cities, in other states, this battle is being waged on everything from prohibiting us from passing anti-fracking ordinances or other environmental regulations to protect our environment or living wage ordinances, as was pointed out in one of your earlier interviews. Someone noted that the cost of living in Miami, Florida is different than in Wakulla County. Mm-hmm. And Miami should be able to figure out what solutions make the most sense for the folks who live in their communities. And that's why people elect them locally.
Mayor Andrew Gillen, Tallahassee, Florida. Let's talk again. Thank you very much for joining us today, Mayor.
Thank you.
Wow, really interesting hour, and I want to thank all three of you for being with us. David Graham of The Atlantic, you wrote it up so well. Link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for being with us from Durham, North Carolina today, David.
Thank you, Tom.
Edward Hill at Ohio State University in Columbus. Terrific perspective. Thank you, Ned. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Michelle Wild Anderson at Stanford, joining us today from San Francisco. Michelle, thank you for your insights today.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.